copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm the child of church planters who were church planting in India when I was born. So I was born in India. And at that stage, church planting meant leading a whole village into multiple individual conversion situations. So you'd really be baptizing a whole village after a process of conversation with that village about who Jesus was. Coming back to the UK, and in the UK, my father was also a church planter, first of all in a Scottish new town, and then in the Midlands of England. And just in case you didn't know, England and Scotland are very different countries. And it's you don't yet need a passport to pass between them, but you might do soon. Anyway, first church was inner city Birmingham, which was a replant situation. In other words, this was an older congregation where the people were commuting in from the suburbs to keep it alive, and the task was to plant the church into the actual neighbourhood so that people from the neighbourhood would come. And it seemed like a bit of a daunting task. In fact, it was a daunting task. But amazingly, the church did grow, and eventually we were kind of at capacity, and we started planting out into the suburbs of Birmingham from that location. And my wife and I went to plant one of those churches in Bourneville, which, if you know anything about England, you'll identify with Cadbury's chocolate. So it's a great smelling place in which to plant a church. So that's where we planted, and I'm still a member of that church, still on the leadership team, but actually after a number of years left to do two things. First of all, to work for the Bible Society, and what we were really looking at in the context of the Bible Society was the issue of Bible distribution and the way in which people in Europe interacted with the Bible or didn't interact with it. Now, actually, our research showed that Bible distribution, Bible availability, was not really an issue in the UK. In fact, we calculated that the average English home had access to 8 Bibles, but nobody was reading them. So the question is, do we take that seriously as a Bible Society, or do we just say, no, our task is to make Bibles available. If people don't want to read them, that's their problem. Well, we did decide to take it seriously for a whole variety of reasons, which I could explain, but we won't. That led into a fascinating journey around the question of, well, what's happening to European culture? A culture which has been formed by the Christian faith and which seems to be walking away from the Christian faith. Because something remarkable happens to a culture when it deserts its own founding roots. So that was a fascinating experiment, and we worked on that for about 15 years. And then nearly 15 years ago, I went to work for an agency that trains people to be church planters in the context of Europe. So I've had 3 kinds of careers. I've been a church planter. I've thought about the issues that might relate to the cultural context into which we're planting in Europe. And I've been training church planters for the past period of time. So 3 almost equal periods in my life. And it's been fascinating. So you could say I am an Anglo-Indian Scot with a passionate commitment to church planting and mission, particularly in a European context. So that's a little bit about me. I hope I'll get to know a little bit about some of you as we go on. So here's how we're going to operate. Because it's a relatively small group, please feel free to interrupt at any particular time. If I think you're interrupting too much, I'll communicate that in ways that you will be quite clear about. But I'm sure you won't. So feel free, rather than store your questions up to the end. However, having said that, I will leave enough time at the end for us to begin to explore some of the issues that we might raise in the meantime. Okay, so I'm hoping that you've had some notes, which maybe even are before you, I don't know. And I'm going to use that framework. So if you've got them there, you'll be able to see what's coming fairly easily, and I'll try and make it clear as to where we are in the presentation. If you haven't got that in front of you, I'll nevertheless give a bit of a signal as to what the nature of the heading is. So we'll follow that structure through. I won't talk for any more than, I think, 40 to 45 minutes to leave plenty of time for discussion. Okay, so the subject is planting mission-shaped churches. And that's a subject I was given. I'm not sure I necessarily would have chosen it, but actually it's been fascinating to think around that particular topic. And there is a context, this is onto the first major slide, there is a context for mission-shaped, which I want to share with you. And it goes all the way back to the work of Leslie Newbegin. Now, I don't know if you all know Leslie Newbegin, but he was a missiologist who had spent most of his life in India as a missionary. And when he returned to England to teach in his retirement, he was astounded to discover that the land he had left as a young missionary was utterly transformed. And he was trying to figure out, well, what has happened in this period of time? Now, it had some indication that something was happening, because even in the context of India, he had sometimes run into young people, particularly in the 1960s, who were on the hippie trail and seeking spiritual enlightenment. And it had struck him as a bit odd that people should come to India to find spiritual enlightenment, because his experience of India was, this is a place that needs spiritual enlightenment. So it's kind of a clue when he came back in the 70s that actually something was going on that was a bit strange, a bit odd. And he wanted to know what that was. So actually, in the late 70s, early 80s, I came across Leslie and began a bit of a conversation. He was actually a near neighbour of mine. And we began to talk about some of these issues, so that when I went to the Bible Society and we began this project of trying to understand what had happened to the culture of Europe, Leslie was a useful ally, plus he was a lot smarter than me, which obviously helped. And we began to work together on something called the Gospel and Our Culture Project. And there was a big conference in 1992, which a team of mine from Bible Society operated. Now, Leslie began with this question: can the West be converted? That's an interesting question, actually. And it was given to him by an Indonesian Christian who knew the West well. He was in the Indonesian government, and he was well-traveled, very sophisticated Christian. And he said to Leslie, is it possible even for the West to be converted, having rejected the faith? So it's not how can we convert the West, it's can the West actually be converted? It's a really good question. And it was kind of the question that underlay Leslie's concern, not just to think about how we present the gospel, which is really the issue of relevance, but how do we engage with this culture, which is actually the question of credibility. Not the relevance of the gospel, but the credibility of the gospel. It's a very different kind of issue, and a much more difficult one. So out of that initial concern, we started this project, The Gospel and Our Culture. And the emphasis was not so much on the gospel and how we present it, but on how we understand what has happened to our culture, and how the gospel might connect with that culture in new kinds of ways. And so from Leslie's point of view, he was looking at everything from history to justice to government to education to arts to media. In fact, many of the things that the European Leadership Forum has also picked up in a variety of ways, Leslie was concerned to think about those things. Now, after Leslie finally did retire, when he was really pretty much 90 years of age, You've got a bit to go yet. And this is the great hope for those of us who are approaching retirement. We keep hoping that we'll turn out to be late developers and that actually there'll still be a career for us. In fact, some of my greatest heroes have their best contribution in their technical retirement. So that's something we need to bear in mind to encourage us. So after Leslie's retirement, what happened was that the Gospel and Our Culture program took quite different directions in Europe than it did in America. And in the European context, what happened was we ran out of money, which is a familiar theme, isn't it, in Europe? We ran out of money. And so actually, it pretty much faded as a concern because of that absence of funding. In the United States, however, there was no shortage of money, and so the conversation went on, but it took an interesting turn, because instead of being a conversation about culture, it became a conversation about the church. And again, that's pretty much what you'd expect in an American context, because the church is much stronger there than it is in Europe. And so the theme began to be, let's figure out how we can fix the church, because if we can fix the church, then we can address the culture. Now, I want to suggest to you that that is almost certainly a dead end for two reasons. First of all, you'll never fix the church. And secondly, if you do want to fix the church, the best way to fix it is actually to engage in mission. And you'll fix it in that context. So for goodness sake, don't stop talking about culture. Keep talking about culture, and by all means talk about the church, but only in that context. Now, predictably, what happened with that conversation was that that also began to run into the sand, because there's a limit to how many conversations you can have about fixing the church. And actually, eventually, that also ran out of steam, but not out of money. So the conversation in the States began to be a conversation about the church. Now, in order to make a distinction for the American church between mission on our doorstep and mission overseas, they coined this interesting word. They made up a word, which was the word missional. It was invented specifically for that purpose, because they discovered that whenever they talked to North American churches about mission, they immediately thought, you're talking about overseas. We are already a missions church. We have X number of missionaries, or we support X number of missionary causes. No, we're talking about how we think about our immediate context. Oh, how is that missions then? So they invented this word, the missional church. And out of that has come what we sometimes call the missional conversation. Now, in more recent times, in a European context, the missional conversation has actually come back on the table. It has partly come back on the table, again, unfortunately, as a conversation about fixing the church, but it's also come back on the table in a variety of other ways, not the least of which is, in fact, church planting, and that's quite hopeful. However, if I'm really honest about it, I'd have to say that the missional conversation, which I think is rich, I think is profound, I think it is deep, I think it is meaningful, has really only reached a few academics and a few early adopters. There's almost no evidence at all to suggest that the missional conversation, needed as it is actually making a difference to the, let's say, the ecclesial institutions, our church institutions. I can see no evidence that church structures are changing in the light of the missional conversation. And that's a problem. And let me just give you one brief illustration of why it's a problem. It's a problem particularly for church planters, but here's why. Let me take an illustration from Holland. I know of one denomination in Holland, which shall remain nameless, mainly because I can't pronounce it, which has invested huge sums of money in church planting. Now, that's, for somebody like me, that's incredibly exciting. But when I look at what they've done, actually what they've done is they've created a kind of department over here on the side, as if to say, this is actually going to make no difference to the rest of us. You know, you church planters over here, here's some money, play, have some fun, and actually maybe we'll get some churches out of it, which will be good. But of course, eventually they'll be like us, won't they? Well, actually, they won't. And that realization has not yet dawned on them. And in point of fact, you can't have a serious commitment to church planting without that church planting, if it's successful, having a profound impact on the existing structures. Now, I think there's going to be a conflict here for those denominations that have invested deeply in church planting, and where the existing structures aren't prepared for the shock that's going to come at some stage when they find that they've actually brought into their midst many, many churches that actually can't be conformed that easily to the existing structures. So there's an issue there. So we've talked about missional in an English context, and because of the Church of England and its relationships with state churches in other lands, there is also a bit of a conversation around something called mission shaped. The Church of England doesn't use the word missional much, it uses the phrase mission shaped. So they're busy at the moment exporting fresh expressions to Germany, Norway, and many other countries through the state churches. And so the language is not missional language, it's mission shaped language. Is there any difference between mission shaped and missional? No. Well, you may be able to find some, in which case you can write a master's thesis about it somewhere, and I'd love to read it. But for all practical purposes, there's only a difference of history. The actual meaning is exactly the same. So whenever you see mission-shaped, you can use the word missional. Whenever you see missional, you can use the word mission-shaped or the phrase mission-shaped, recognizing that they have different origins, but actually essentially they're talking about the same thing. So, on to the next slide. If I had a PowerPoint presentation, I'd click the clicker at this point. What do we mean when we talk about mission-shaped? What is mission-shaped? Well, because we are products of modernity, we love to look for programs, don't we? So we tend to think, mission-shaped church, that must be a program. So what are the elements of the program? We can learn it and implement it. However, it's not a program. Okay, if it's not a program, then it must be a new model of church. That's our other default position, isn't it? We're looking for a new model of church. It isn't a new model of church. And by the way, I do want to say that those of us who are looking for a new model of church to fix things are going to be disappointed. There is no new model of church, no postmodern way of being church. That's not to say that new models won't emerge, but it's not something that we can invent in some workshop somewhere and present to you as the solution, having done the analysis. That's a way of thinking that has come to us from the Enlightenment. And it's not going to happen in terms of mission engagement with European culture. So if it's not a program and it's not a new model of church, what is it? Well, it's actually a different way of thinking about our context. And strangely enough, the people that have figured this out most thoroughly are actually the Roman Catholics, which is a bit of a surprise to me. But let me just illustrate the way in which their thinking has gone, so that we can begin to get a feel for what we're actually talking about here. In the Roman Catholic Church, they only had two categories for thinking about mission and evangelism. A place was either evangelized, in which case the category was the church, or it wasn't evangelized, in which case the category was mission. That's fairly simple, isn't it? So where there is no church, you send missionaries until the church exists. And then you talk about evangelism. Now, actually, Protestants have had similar sorts of thinking as well, but not quite as sharply divided as that. In the Roman Catholic Church, it's very, very clear. However, what has happened is that in the 1970s and 1980s, the church, the Catholic Church, began to realise that life wasn't quite that simple. And that actually, in Europe in particular, but also in many other parts of the world, they were seeing a new phenomenon where cultures that had been Christian were now no longer Christian. So you couldn't say the church wasn't there, but neither could you say that mission wasn't needed. And so they began to invent a new category to cope with this. Because, as you know, Catholics don't like it when they haven't got a category for something. And so the category is called the new evangelization. And that's what they mean when they say the new evangelization. John Paul II, a famous quote, said this, not a re-evangelization, but a new evangelization. New in its ardour, we could say its passion, in its methods and in its expression. Fresh expression. It's interesting. He said that a long time ago, in actual fact. He said that in the 1980s. And it's actually a helpful thing, because what it's done in the Catholic Church is that it's opened people up to begin to think in completely new ways. And if you were to say to Catholic missiologists, so what is this new way? And all they will say at this stage is, we don't know. It's a third space that we can't describe. But we're trying to figure out what it could look like. But at the moment, we actually don't know. And we're struggling to figure out what it might mean. Now, actually, I think that's helpful too for us, for Protestants, because I think that is the reality in terms of Europe. It's not a new mission field in one way, because the church still exists, and in some cases can be brought back into life. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that something pretty radical is going to have to happen in terms of the existing churches, which, for the most part, have dramatically failed in terms of the way in which European culture has marched in recent times. So there's this third space which we're all struggling to figure out. So if we're all struggling to figure it out, what on earth can we say about it? Well, I want to say some things about it, and I want to say that in my view, for church planters, when we come to plant a church, remember what we said earlier, we're thinking about the context in which we're operating. We're thinking about the context. Incredibly important. Because here's the reality about Europe. There are lots of indications that those under 40 are living in a strange and contradictory world, because on the one hand they're increasingly saying we're either atheists or agnostics, but at the same time they're saying, but we're desperately searching for spiritual encounter. And they're saying both things at the same time. Now we might say that that doesn't make sense, and it probably doesn't, but that's the existential reality that people are living in. So for example, if you take a movement, a youth movement like Steiger, I don't know if you've come across Steiger. It's a fascinating movement. They take rock bands, Christian rock bands, into public arenas, and they try and use that to make connection with youth. And what they're finding again and again and again are two things. First of all, that young people are amazingly open to the gospel if it's presented in a cultural form that they can connect with. And secondly, that it's almost impossible, even once you've discipled one of these young people, to fit them into existing churches. that's a problem, isn't it? That's a huge problem. But it just reinforces the reality that we have to think in church planting terms about our context. What kinds of churches would function well in the context into which we're going? So bearing that in mind, I want to suggest to you that as we do church planting, imagine three overlapping circles in your mind. We have to work on three overlapping areas simultaneously as we're engaging in church planting that takes account of context. What are they? The first is the area of leadership. And leadership in this new context is going to look different. What is leadership going to look like in this context? Well, the first thing we need to say about it is that leadership is always more than one. Leadership is always more than one. It's not leader, it's leadership. Now, that's, strangely enough, a shift, because when I trained for ministry in the very late 1960s, early 1970s, actually the expectation was that leadership was always one. almost regardless of denomination, that actually you might have some lay leaders, but by and large, what was important was the one leader that was going to go into the situation. Now, actually, we sometimes forget that it was so much orientated in that way. But today, leadership is always about team. And it's about team for a whole variety of reasons. One of the reasons, of course, is the fact that in the complexity of the situation that we face, none of us have all the gifts that will be necessary in order to break open this new situation. But it's not just for that reason. It's also because there's something about the gospel that always speaks about community. Whether it's the nature of the Godhead in the form of Father, Son, and Spirit, or whether it's just the impact of the gospel in bringing into being transformed relationships. We're not called just to be individual followers. We're called into a community of believers all the time. We're called into community. And actually, in a mission situation, leadership has to reflect that reality. Now, there is a dimension of giftedness, and I want to think about that for a moment. Now, you'll know that many, many people who are writing in this area talk about the fivefold gifts from Ephesians 11. Now, sometimes a bit too much is made of that, because there's only so much weight that one passage of Scripture will bear. But nevertheless, let's just stick with that for a minute. Let's just think about apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers. Now, you know very well that in the last hundreds of years, that fivefold gifting has been reduced in leadership terms to pastor teacher. You know that. And there are good reasons why that's the case, by the way. One of the reasons being that in a situation where everybody is nominally Christian, the task of ministry becomes to care for those who are Christians and to teach those who are Christians to be better Christians. The other giftings don't have so much immediate relevance in a situation where everybody is actually or nominally Christian. I'm not saying they've disappeared entirely. I'm just saying they don't have as much relevance. But in a mission situation, they become incredibly relevant, because what's the apostolic about? It's about starting new things. And particularly in terms of the church, it's about, if you like, being the church before the church comes into being. So there's something about the apostolic person that kind of guarantees the church before it actually becomes a reality. It's something about their personhood. It's something about the faith that they have that actually creates the church before it arrives. The prophetic, that ability to be able to see, hear, and understand what God might be saying in a given situation is incredibly important. And of course, the evangelistic is important for obvious reasons, the ability to be able to communicate well in new cultural situations. So these, if you like, are entrepreneurial gifts, which for many, many years have tended to be expressed in the Western church through overseas missions. You know, if you've got one of these gifts, mm-hmm. I think the Lord is calling you to go far from here. Actually, very far. Indeed, the further the better, because these are actually quite disturbing gifts, aren't they? They unsettle the status quo in all sorts of ways. And so we kind of want to separate these people out. If we can't actually persuade them to go overseas, a parachurch agency, that would be a good idea, wouldn't it? Youth with a mission, youth for Christ, anything but, you know, hanging around here causing trouble. Some people, of course, don't make it into any Christian agency and they end up going into business. And they think to themselves, I'll make money and give money to missions or whatever. And I've met lots and lots of very successful business people who've told me that they actually put their names forward for ministry and they were turned down. And they could never understand why, because it obviously wasn't lack of competence, lack of ability. But I can tell you why they were turned down, because they were disturbing people. In the sense that it was obvious to those who were interviewing them, if they let this person in, things were going to have to change. And that wasn't something that was that's very welcome in church bureaucracies. Change is not something that we understand very well. So it is a helpful concept to begin to say, well, when we talk about new leadership teams, what do we mean? It's just a useful way of saying, well, what access do we have? Now, note what I'm saying here. Not how can we persuade every church to have an apostle, a prophet, an evangelist, a pastor, and a teacher, five leaders, especially five paid leaders. That's not what we're talking about. It doesn't operate like that. But have access to some of these giftings. That access may mean that actually it's somebody in a region that brings the apostolic. It may mean that there's somebody in the ministry team that actually only spends a little bit of time in that local church and they spend some time taking other initiatives. It can be configured in a whole variety of ways. So there's no set pattern here. It's only simply saying somehow or another we need to get access to these kinds of giftings, and we can be pretty flexible about the ways in which we do that. It's also important to remember that actually this isn't an exhaustive list. There are all kinds of other giftings that we need in team besides these. So don't take that as an exhaustive list. Take it just as a provocative piece to begin thinking differently about the nature of leadership.
Sorry, you said we can interrupt when, so I want to bring the ice. Can I?
Say that again?
Can I interrupt you?
Please do. Yes, by all means. I think it's a good thing to interrupt me personally. But anyway, carry on.
You spoke about fivefold ministries. Do you recommend when a team is started, of course, the team should have a leader, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you recommend that this leader, it's a better way to be an apostle? Because apostles start new things.
Yeah. I think the evidence would seem to suggest that churches which are newly planted and have more success, the person that leads them tends to have those apostolic gifts, yeah. Now, the reason I'm putting it that way is because I don't want us to start nominating people as apostles and saying, you know, we've got this new office in the church now, because I think these are gifts and ministries, they're not offices. But for sure, if you're not going to have somebody with those kinds of apostolic giftings, you're probably going to struggle to get a church planted. Now, it used to be different, because it used to be the case when we still had Christendom that a pastor teacher could plant a church, because a pastor teacher was simply gathering the faithful. So if you went into a new area where there'd never been a church before, actually it was called church extension in those days, not church planting. And that's the difference. Church extension is where you're providing facilities for the faithful. What are you providing for the faithful? A pastor, a program, and a building. Expensive, but non-controversial. If you're doing church planting, where you're actually thinking not about providing facilities for the faithful, but about bringing people to Christ for the very first time, and that many of those people might actually be part of your founding group, that's a different gift set. And there's very few pastor teachers that can do that kind of thing.
Could you tell more about this limitation of five, the taking only Ephesians 4 like a basis?
Yeah, well...
You suggested yeah. to have a longer list and so...
Yeah, well, for example, the gift of organization.
Sure.
The gift of administration. The gift of service, the gift of generosity. You know, there are many, many other gifts that we'd want to see in a broader leadership team. Mm-hmm. So this is useful to just as a provocative question. But actually, when we're thinking about a team over a longer period of time, there are other giftings that we want to be thinking about as well. And remember that it's not that every person has one gift each. Sure. Most people have a mixture of gifts, don't they? So we can see, you know, there may be three people in a leadership team, but actually six or eight gifts in that team through those three individuals. So it's just a way of cautioning against, let's not go for rigid patterns and rigid formula. We've got to be a bit more flexible than that. But it's nevertheless a good starting point. What I can say a bit more dogmatically is this: the purpose of team... The purpose of a leadership team is to equip the saints.
Yes.
That's the purpose of it. And it's surprising. I mean, we all know that that's true. But actually, I am amazed how many times I hear leaders say to their congregation, "Your job is to support my ministry." Now, I kind of know what they mean. It's certainly not their job to undermine his ministry, which some lay people think it is. But actually, that's not the right emphasis at all, is it? It would be legitimate for laity to say to our leadership teams, "Now your job is to support my ministry," or our ministry, actually. The emphasis on our, because we're trying to create community here. And that's the other point about leadership team, is that there's a very important sense in which the teams that we're trying to create will model the community that we're trying to bring into being. They will model the community in terms of relationships and in terms of, let's be blunt about it, a sense of fun. You know, if ministry just makes us miserable, we're doing something wrong. Now, I'm not saying that ministry can't be demanding, it can be difficult, it can be heartbreaking on occasion, but actually, I want to say to you, there's nothing else I'd rather be doing. And regularly, every 6 months in our local church team, we stop and ask ourselves the question, are we still having fun? And actually, we are. We are still having fun. Because we're seeing God move in our team and in our church. And when you see God move in your team and your church, you're having fun. Sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's challenging, sometimes it's demanding, but fundamentally, it's the kind of thing that gets me up in the morning to think there's a possibility that more people are going to hear the good news of Jesus today. That gets me out of bed in the morning. Better than any cup of coffee. Though I like the coffee too, actually. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about that first circle. And it's something we never stop working on. It's not that we get the leadership right and then we move to the next thing. It's a work in progress and it stays a work in progress. Leadership. The second area is paying attention to the community life of the church itself. So congregational life, we could say. I've got this little phrase in the notes you'll see. It's an English word that actually even in England we don't use very often. The community that we're creating needs to be a redolent of the gospel. Redolent, that's an interesting word, isn't it? What does redolent mean? See, even those who speak it, well, no, you're American, aren't you? Sorry. Even those who speak English don't use the word redolent very often. But it kind of means it smells of, it tastes of, it looks like, it feels like. It's a sort of mixture of all those things. It somehow deeply reflects the gospel. It's a nice little word, redolent. And I use it because it's useful, because I have to explain it.
That's because you went to school, we went to shore.
I went to school in Scotland, which is where you get the best education, actually. Very similar story. So, redolent of the gospel. In other words, when people walk into our churches, they ought to be able to figure out what our message is just by watching us. Just recently, we had a 60-year-old man walk into our church, and he just stood at the back. And at the end of the service, I knew who he was. And I said, "Malcolm, you've never been to our church before. Have you ever been to church before?" He said, "No, never." He said, "I've been to the odd wedding and the odd funeral, but I've never actually been to church." I said, "Oh, what did you think of it?" He said, "You've got community here." I said, "Really? Why do you say that?" He said, "Because I see young speaking to old. I see people not going home." And he pointed out to me what I hadn't actually noticed myself. These are the signs of community. He said, "I love it. You've got community here. That's great, isn't it?" If when we behave in our normal life, people can get a sense of what the message is, something's happening. These last few years, we've offered... our church has taken over community centre, and we can offer to marry people in the community centre now. And often people come and ask for marriages that aren't part of our church, and we say, "Fine, okay. Before we take this any further, come 3 times to church, and then we'll talk." And interesting reaction you get, because these are people that they think they know what church is, okay. And they think they want a Christian wedding service, which is nice, but they actually don't know anything about the gospel, really. I would say, in the overwhelming majority of cases, they come to church and end up in tears. And often we talk with martyrs and say, "What was going on for you in the service?" They say, "We don't really know, because we just never experienced anything like this before. But it was strange. I would never normally cry in public." These are men as well as women. "So, well, do you think it's because you were sensing God?" "That's it. I've been looking for that all my life. And I sense it." Now, we kind of take it for granted, because it's part of our experience, isn't it, that God turns up. But when God turns up for the complete unbeliever, it's a bit of a shock. And so they often start crying. But that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying that what we're doing needs to be redolent of the gospel. And partly that's going to mean a generosity and a hospitality. That's why the welcome is so important in church. We're not doing it as a device. We're doing it because it's part of the gospel. And I love it when we have a generosity that extends to regular food. It's great, isn't it? We often have meals, and because it's a community centre and people are walking by, if it's a nice day, in fact, I think there might even be this in our church today, actually. If it's a nice day, all the doors will be open to the park and big tables down the middle. And it's interesting, actually, because we feed ourselves and people just wander in from the community and start taking our food. Now, I could imagine some churches that would say, "Excuse me, this isn't for you. This is a private function." But we love it when people come in and start taking our food. That tells us we're doing something right. If there's a sense of welcome that would cause people to just wander in and help themselves, that's fantastic. That's redolent of the gospel, isn't it? And food is, I think, particularly important. Just think about the important occasions in the Gospels when tables matter. You know, Jesus begins his ministry, according to John, at a wedding, and all the tables of food and everything else, and of course wine, which we don't tend to talk about quite so much, do we? In certain circles. But of course, there is an explanation as to how he turned it into non-alcoholic wine, but we won't go there today. But you know, just amazing. I love the story as a Sunday school child of Zacchaeus. We used to get the story told on flannel graphs. Do you remember flannel graphs? Mm-hmm. Apparently they're making a comeback because they're now multimedia. But Zacchaeus, come down from that tree, because I'm coming to your home today to eat at table with you. And isn't it interesting that it was actually at table that Zacchaeus' life was changed? It wasn't actually the revival meeting when he was up the tree. It was at table. And again and again and again, we see at table on the road to Emmaus, and so on and so forth, that people's lives are changed. And you know yourself, don't you, that you could talk to somebody after church for years, but when you invite them to your home for a meal, your relationship with them is utterly transformed. Over table, something happens that somehow doesn't happen in any other way. We are enfleshed beings, and the flesh needs that kind of engagement, that kind of sucker, if you like, and something happens in the transaction that causes people to open up, and we learn things about people that we would never learn in any other way. Now, all of that needs to be undergirded by the creation of spiritual practices. Spiritual practices. But there isn't time to go into what we mean by that, so I won't go into it in detail, except to say that the rhythm of prayer and the rhythm of worship and the rhythm of reading the scripture is actually quite an important part of constantly reminding us that God is the air we breathe. That's quite important. Because actually what's happened to our culture in these last few hundred years is we can live quite satisfactorily without God. Can't we? Our neighbours do. In one way. They live without God. And actually we choose to live with God. But that's an interesting choice. Because it is a choice. And actually what we want to do is to build into that choice the kind of practices that constantly make us alive to and aware of God as a living presence. Because actually what our culture has successfully done is blank God out. God is not the air that our culture breathes. But when you go to Africa, when you go to South America, and you go to Asia, God is the air that people breathe. And one of the ways in which we reintroduce that sense of God awareness is by introducing spiritual practices as a rhythm and as a cycle in people's lives that constantly remind us God is here. God is here. And that makes a difference to the way we live and have our being. So part of the task is actually creating this kind of atmosphere. So we've got a leadership team that does that. We've got a congregation that lives in this kind of way. And then lastly, we pay attention. Well, not lastly, it's all happening at the same time. We're paying attention to our neighborhood, to our context, to our immediate context. And let me just illustrate what we need to be doing here. First of all, we're listening and looking for the presence of God. What is God up to in our neighborhood? Because he's up to lots of things, actually. We had a community festival last Monday, and it was a community festival. It wasn't something to trick people into church. It was it was a community festival, and 5,000 people turned up from the community. And we had all sorts of fascinating conversations. I was talking to one guy, and he said, is it a church that's behind this? I said, yeah. He said, do you know anybody that goes to that church? I said, well, I do. Oh, he said, only I live 10 doors down. I didn't realize that there's a church here. But here's the thing. My daughter, who's 7 or 8, has been saying to me, Daddy, can we go to church? And he said, I didn't know how to respond to that. He said, I suppose I could come here, couldn't I? Would that be okay? Isn't that interesting? God is at work with so many people in our community, but we don't know what he's saying to them and what he's doing. And somehow we have to be building those connections with the community so that we can have those conversations that begin to sensitize us to the reality that God is at work. He's very busy, actually. But we haven't always heard and listened to what he's up to. Now, some of the people that are key in this process are actually not members of our church at all yet, but they are the people of peace that we think about in Luke's gospel when Jesus sends out the 70. They are the people of peace who have immediate access to whole networks that we don't have access to. A friend of mine is starting a church, has started a church actually. In fact, it's only about a mile and a half, 3 kilometres or so from where I am living, but it's a wholly different world. It's one of these really tough working class estates where people have tried to start churches for years and failed and failed and failed and failed. And he's got a church of 80 or 90 people now, all of whom are converts. How did that happen? He baptized 12 last week. Well, here's how it happened. One of the first converts was a drug dealer. And his networks in the community were brilliant. And when he gave invitations to people to come to things, they tended to come. He made them offers they could hardly refuse. He was a person of peace. Now, who are the people of peace in our community that will begin to open up that community for us? How do we move back into the neighborhood in such a way that we begin to inhabit that neighborhood? You know, sometimes what has happened is that I'm going to skip a little piece here. What has happened is that very often the conversation with the community has become quite impoverished. In fact, I know many, many churches that just don't have any conversation with their community. In fact, they would even say, we don't really care about our community. Or if there is a conversation at all, it tends to be this: why don't you come to our church anymore? Now, that's not much of a conversation, is it? Why don't you come to our church anymore? You might just as well say, actually, do you even like us? Or it's another way of saying, you're actually not like us, are you? And that's why we're here and you're there. You're not like us and we don't much like you. We wish you were more like us. Well, this isn't a helpful conversation, folks. But it's where most of our churches are. in terms of their conversation. They were wishing their community were more like them and that they'd turn up to their church services. What's wrong with them? Well, actually, somehow we have to have a different kind of conversation. And that different conversation might begin by responding to the needs that we see in our community. And sometimes they're not desperately difficult needs to respond to. We actually did a survey in our area and we discovered that the top three needs were these. One, there's no children's playground. Two, there is no place where people with children can meet and have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. And thirdly, there's nothing for youth. And so we began by providing a playground because we had the land right next to our building. So we provided a playground. And then we provided a cafe next to the playground. And that completely changed the conversation with the community because, number one, the community realized we didn't do that for us. We did it for them. And it provides an arena in which a round table, the coffee table in this case, we have lots and lots of very interesting conversations. Now, you know, that's not an amazing social need that we've responded to, but it was the need that people were expressing. What are the needs in our neighbourhood? How do we begin to change the conversation? And at a very profound level, at a very deep level, how do we ask the question, what would it mean for us to flourish as a community? What would it mean for us to flourish as humanity in this neighborhood? It's fascinating when we ask the question that way, how many people who are not Christians bring up the question about God? Because they might not bring it up in quite that way, but actually many people who are concerned about human flourishing recognize that there is a dimension to life that cannot be addressed without some concern for the spiritual, without some concern for the moral, without some concern for that which we would commonly think of in terms of God. The question about human flourishing opens up the question about our spiritual life, and it provides common ground because there are very, very few people that don't want a conversation about human flourishing. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean for our community to flourish in this context? Okay, so what I'm suggesting is that in the business of church planting, we're doing these three things all at the same time. They're in three separate but related circles, and that's part of the difficulty of our missionary context, that actually is quite hard to do all these three things simultaneously, but that's the nature of the task. And if we pay attention to these three things, what will emerge quite naturally from all of that is the very different kind of church, which at the moment we don't have models for, which at the moment we can't necessarily describe, which at the moment we can't even predict. But it will arise as we involve ourselves in these missionary tasks. Okay, well, I've talked for a little bit longer than I intended to, for which I apologise. But there is time for us to begin to open up discussion around these themes. So feel free to say whatever you would like. Andy.
Martin, thank you so much for that. Really, really helpful. Societies are very complex, multifaceted, and where we work, where I live, is one of the poorest areas in inner city. And what we discover is, for example, there are lots of refugee groups, and food has been a wonderful resource for us, and to eat together, and for incoming communities for whom community is very strong, has been, it's been a wonderful gospel tool, but at one and the same time, the indigenous white population do not, eating is an individual activity. It's not a corporate activity. You don't eat with someone else. You don't certainly don't sit around a dining room table.
Yeah.
You eat on your own, maybe from the local takeaway, or if you eat, you eat in front of the television. And it is just trying to work out.
Yeah.
No one approach fits all, and we have to be sensitive to the immense complexities of the communities yeah. in which we find ourselves.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And what I was describing in our situation is very middle class, and people do still eat together. So that's a good observation. A friend of mine who's actually a Nigerian missionary to Britain, and who's tried to reach exclusively white working class people. He asked himself the question, so where do people meet in this community? And it was around the time of the World Cup, and he thought, they're all down the pub. So he said to his wife, I'm going to go down to the pub. And she said, what? You can't do that. No African pastor can be seen in a pub. His ministry will be finished. It will be over. He said, but that's what I think I should do. Well, he was a student of mine at the time, so she wanted to phone me up so that I could instruct him not to go. She didn't phone him, fortunately, because I wouldn't have been able to give that instruction. Anyway, he did go, and the first response from the guys was, what are you doing here? I mean, really and truly, they were a bit hostile. You know, black people don't come here. And he said, I've come to see what you do. He said, well, they said, well, we're watching the World Cup. He said, that's great, because I'm an FA football coach, registered football coach. They said, really? He said, yeah. Totally different conversation. They weren't eating together, but they were drinking together. He didn't have to drink alcohol, and he didn't. But then the other thing that they discovered in community was this business of he was a proper FA accredited coach. And so now they invited him to coach all their children and grandchildren. So they've got this huge community of conversation now around sport and the pub, which is where they meet to talk and meet to play. And now he's starting to get invitations to, you know, will you come and bless this house? Will you come and do this? And will you come and do the other? So he's become their community pastor. Nobody's yet come to Christ, but this is, we're talking months now, not years. But he's beginning to do the initial work that will result in people coming to Christ. They're coming to his church. They haven't made commitments yet. But very interesting. So you're right. Particular contexts have got quite different social mechanisms. So it's spotting what the social mechanisms are and having the imagination to cross into those social mechanisms. Yeah.
Martin, can you give us a little bit, just briefly, insight on how to exegete a culture, a neighborhood, a context?
I think the first thing is listening and watching. So how does a neighborhood work? What are the patterns of behavior? And sometimes, I know it seems a bit strange, sometimes it's just a matter of walking around a given community to observe its rhythms and its patterns, because communities have different rhythms and patterns. So if you walk around a given community at 8 in the morning, it's going to be different than midday, it's going to be different than late afternoon, and so on and so forth. So what are the rhythms and patterns in a given community? Who are the people of influence in a given community? Who has a voice? And more importantly, who doesn't have a voice? And then within that context, trying to figure out who are the people of peace around here, and how would we begin to get into a conversation with them? Out of those conversations, you begin to answer that other question which we addressed earlier, which is, and what are the needs in this community? What needs are we called to address, and what needs are we not called to address? But I do think the people of peace is these are absolutely key to the whole thing. my very first church, which was a replant in inner city Birmingham, I had no idea what to do, to be really honest. So in ignorance and desperation, we just went door to door and said to people, would you like to come to a Bible study on the person of Jesus? Completely stupid thing to do. But amazingly, in the first 100 homes, 20 people said yes, 12 came, and 6 got converted, which were the first conversions this church had seen in 25 years. So it was amazing, actually. But what I didn't realise at the time was that the reason so many responded was because the first home that we called on was actually a person of peace for that street. And this particular person said, if you're going to have such a study, you better have it at my home. So every other home we went to, we were saying it was going to be at this person's home. Immediately, we got receptivity. Rose, whose home it was, didn't actually become a Christian then. She became a Christian eventually about 3 years later. But her neighbours became Christians because the Bible study had been held in her home. She was the street mother that everybody went to if they had a problem. So who are the people of peace? Because these are the ones that give us access.
Yeah. You said self-deprecatingly, what a stupid thing to do. Was it really a stupid thing to do? Because the thing is, you see...
the only thing I knew what to do.
But my point is that often, because we're so far into what you're talking about, that we oppose things that aren't necessarily to be opposed. So, for example, going door-to-door, being humble and gracious about how you do it, and getting into contact with people. In France, our situation is so desperately small that we have to find some way of getting into touch with people that won't bump into a Christian in any other way. And so going door to door isn't a first choice and isn't a natural, comfortable choice for anybody. Nobody likes it.
Yeah.
And very few people like having it happen to them. But, I mean, perhaps that was exactly the right thing to do at that time. And perhaps it could be exactly the right thing for us to do in certain circumstances, in certain ways, in our contexts. Do you understand?
Look, I completely agree with you, and I don't regret doing it, because as really and truly, it was the only thing I think it probably was the only thing, if we'd done the analysis, that we could do, given that the church had had no contact with anybody in that community for decades. Where would you start? It was a curious kind of feeling of desperation in a way. But and I was genuinely amazed at the response that came. So God was very gracious to us, really.
Yeah. And would you do it today in certain contexts? Would you advise?
I might do, actually. I might do. I wouldn't say I wouldn't do it. But at the same time, it's very resource intensive. So if I could find another method, I might. But. Hey, nothing's ruled out and nothing's ruled in, is it, with the business of just beginning? Because in the end of the day, we just want conversations, don't we? We just want conversations, as many conversations as we can possibly have in a given community, working on the basis that God is working in a percentage of people's lives and we just need to meet them. So if we can send in a team of 50 to have those conversations, and with a different methodology, that's great. But in this particular case, there was me. So that was all I could do.
Malcolm Gladwell, in his book, The Tipping Point, mentions three people that I think are, they clothe the person of the piece in terms of who they are. They're connectors, they're mavens, and they're salesmen. The maven is the person who knows a lot about lots of things. People go to him for knowledge. The connector connects different sociological groups with one another, and the salesman is good in selling things. And you can ask in a new context, the people who live there, who are these people in your context? Can you introduce me to them? I think these are seminal relationships that we need to foster.
Yeah, absolutely. That's brilliant. And it was interesting. I mean, later on, we grew faster through people's natural relationships, people who were coming to faith, and so you start to get multiplication, which was, you know, wonderful. But those six converts were the breakthrough, and it was almost a miracle, really, for that church. Yeah, you think six converts? Well, what's that? Hmm? Pardon?
Definitely a miracle.
It was a miracle, because I mean, I remember in the first week. wondering what on earth I'd done, because the senior elder said to me, I joined this church 35 years ago, which was, it was 35 years ago. So it's roughly late 30s, early 40s he joined. And it's been in decline ever since. Now, he wasn't making the causal connection between his arrival and the... but actually, it was true. When I looked at the figures, the church, I think the decline started in 1935. And it's been absolutely unremitting. Every year, without fail, they'd been in decline from 1935 to when I arrived in 1974. I mean, talk about soul destroying. Sapping of faith and hope. Just terrible, really. And before that, it'd been a thriving church, trusted in the community, big Sunday school work, lots of community work, and a great conversation with the community. But something happened, and then they got into this cycle of decline. So the previous baptism had been sort of 1954 or something. It was something like that. And here we were in 1974. It was just amazing, actually. And very elderly people. So I think the average attendance was 22 on a Sunday morning. And it was also one of these situations where you really didn't want to bring anybody to church, you know, because it was dreadful. Even my best friend, I wouldn't necessarily bring them, because it was just such a horrible experience of church. But anyway, somehow God brought the difference, which is amazing. Good. Well, thank you for being patient and listening so attentively. My admiration goes out to you all. And I think we are pretty much on time. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.